the source number 6. Elihu has said so far, God sends messages via dreams and harm, and via Elihu himself. That was in his first speech. I numbered them based on which speech they show up in. God's benevolence to society shows that God is not destructive and is indeed just. That was in his second speech. And then his third speech, God responds to the way you treat other people, so there is benefit to being good, so there. That was his third speech. And then the overall theme of repent, acknowledge your deeds, express regret, accept that you will not repeat it, which was really in the first and second speech, although he did mention prayer in the at the end of the third one. We now get to his last speech, chapter 36, 37. And here, I showed you the structure in source number 7. I'm going to show you it's really two lessons, two separate ones. I'm hoping to get through his first one today. And what would be really great would be if we can get through his first lesson today, his next lesson, which is his last one, next week, then the week before Pesach, we get to meet God. We get to have the introduction to God's speeches to Job. That would be a nice way to go into Pesach. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But the structure, as I outlined it on your sheet, and as always, there are multiple ways that you could read the structure, begins with four sentences of Elihu saying, I'm not done yet, just in case he thought he was. Then it follows with the middle of the chapter, 5 to 15, which says that God communicates by protecting and punishing as appropriate, which is a theme we've already seen, right? We saw him say that in his first speech, that that's communication. Then the suffering God inflicts saves people from worse suffering, which is the part that you wanted to talk about, so that's where we're getting there, in terms of how suffering can actually help a person. Then he's going to shift gears, and we'll get to the latter part, which I don't think we'll get to this week, where he talks about God being mighty beyond our understanding, as exemplified in storms, rain, snow, thunder and lightning, that sort of thing. And it'll be concluded with, Job, what do you know of God anyway? That's the structure of this last speech. So really, the two major themes are going to be, first, sort of a recap of what he's done so far. God communicating by protecting people, the suffering is actually good for you. And then second, God being mighty beyond our understanding will be the latter half of this. Susan?
When you say that you learn from your pain, isn't that like a theme? Like, it's not a new theme.
Correct.
It's always been said, you know, you get to be a better person if you've seen people, you know, or you've suffered, you realize what other people, you become more empathetic.
I mean, it's certainly a broader human message. Beyond it being a broader human message, it's a message we've seen in the book before about learning from it. Yeah, Elihu is not necessarily breaking new ground with this. We'll see. In general, the themes we're going to see here are, number one, you are suffering at God's hands, but the suffering is actually a positive for you. It warns you away from bad behavior, and it prevents worse suffering in the future. It's sort of like the scientific explanation of the sensory nerves. You touch something hot, you pull your hand away, right? Why is it that we have sensory nerves to tell us this is painful? In order to warn us away. So what God is doing is the equivalent of the sensory nerve. He is sending you pain so that you will know to stop doing what you're doing. That's the way that Elihu paints it.
But Elihu still hasn't said exactly what he's doing, other than not praying to God directly.
You mean what Job has done wrong?
Yeah.
The only thing we have so far, really, was that in the third speech, it sounded like he was saying you've harmed other people, but he wasn't specific.
You might have.
He might, maybe. Some believe that he hasn't
prayed to God. Is that
well, that's also, yeah. That's yes, I suppose that will be part of it too. That's his first theme. And then his second theme is you claim to understand God, but you can't understand God. So his idea of exploring the idea of suffering as a positive is not entirely new with him. Bildad in chapter 8, where we talked about the transplanted tree, right? At least within one read of that chapter, was saying that suffering can be a positive. The idea of God being way above us is not new either. We've seen that one in the book repeatedly. So don't expect Elihu to break new ground much here. We'll have to see whether there's anything here that could be considered new. But we begin with the traditional beginning of Elihu of, I'm not done yet. Sentences 1 to 4. Vayosef Elihu vayomar. And Elihu added or continued and said. That's new. Right? In the previous chapter, it began Vayan Elihu. Elihu declared and said. And in the previous speech as well, chapter 34, it began with Vayan Elihu vayomar. He declared and said. Vayan doesn't mean answered. Vayan means declared. But either way, here we have Vayosef. So two different approaches to what Vayosef is. The Drash approach, brought by Rashi, is to say that Rashi is quoting Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan. He says that this is the fourth speech. Job had three visitors, one speech for each visitor, because remember that Elihu was angry at the visitors, right? So one speech for each visitor, and then the fourth is the cherry on top. So that's Vayosef, and then he added. The Mitzudat David approach is different, and I think very straightforward, is that really what you're going to see in this speech doesn't really break new ground. What Elihu did in the earlier speeches responded to Job's main points, and what he's going to do here is just to reinforce what he has said before. Therefore, it's Vayosef, and he added the following, but not much is new here. Yes, Elisheva.
Also, in our previous understanding of Vayan, is it time for Elihu
yes.
to respond? And also, we did also take a Vayosef in Parakav 10 when Eov continued.
Yes.
He just added to what's been before. So there was something about.
Right, this Vayosef seems to be used either for some kind of final or valedictory kind of a statement. It's a good point that we saw it in 29. I mean, in terms of the pause, it's not clear to me whether there is or is not a pause here. I don't know. Okay. So he says to Job, Pasuk Bet, sentence 2, beginning with Aramaic, Katar li ze'er v'achaveka. Those who miss Aramaic from what we did, Daniel, you've got your Aramaic fix. Katar li ze'er v'achaveka. Katar. What does that sound like to you? Keter, which is a? How in the world does that fit here? So the Art Scroll translates it as wait. Katar li ze'er v'achaveka. Wait for me a little. Ze'er is indeed a little. Right? And I will tell you. Hang on. Ki od leilo kamilim, because God still has words, in case you thought otherwise. Susan, what were you going to say?
Here they first translate it as suffer, and then here they explain why they say suffer.
Why do they say suffer?
Even as it points out, the similarity of the unusual word to the Hebrew keter, crown,
yeah.
suggests as the meaning, show me a little honor.
Yes.
Eliyahu still has important arguments to advance to justify God's face.
Right, that's not suffer. Oh, they don't mean suffer that way. They're using suffer in the old English way.
Oh.
Suffer as in wait.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's how they're using suffer like that. Okay. But yes, the other approach that I was going to bring you, first of all, Rashi and others show it as wait because they point out that in Isaiah chapter 42, sentence 4, the word yichalu is translated by the Targum as yikaterun. So keter is used to refer to waiting. However, Ibn Ezra's approach is indeed to say it's like bi yachtiru tzadikim in Tehillim. Yachtiru is to show respect, to crown. And what he's saying is, show me respect a little bit, meaning give me space to speak a little bit more, and then I'm going to tell you, ki od leloka milim, there are still words to God, which either means there's more to say in defense of God, or, alternatively, God is still sending me things to say. Because remember that in chapter 32, sentence 8, he said, God is sending me words. So he says, God's not done yet. Wait, there's more prophecy to give. Don't pull me off the stage just yet.
Does he feel he's like a prophet, or an angel?
Yes, I think so.
Or is he an angel? Is he a conduit? What is he?
Yeah, no, conduit, prophet, whatever term you want. He absolutely believes that he is on a mission to correct everybody in the room. We know people like that.
And it comes from God. No.
And then it comes from God, you bet.
Okay, let's see some.
If he's using Aramaic, can you now situate the storyline just in terms of a timeline? Can I say that he must be at certain
right, so. Right, and the answer is it's a good thought, but not necessarily, because first of all, the time frame in which Aramaic is used is very broad, depending on where you are. Second, because so much of the language of the book in general is ancient Semitic languages of one kind or another blended in with Hebrew. So it's really hard to figure out, unless you're going to suggest timing him as different from the others. In other words, if you're going to suggest we use this for Elihu's speech in particular, that would be an interesting initiative, because most of his speech has been Hebrew. So that would be an interesting possibility. But I wouldn't know where to begin in order to really do it properly. So he says, there's more to be said. Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3. Esad dei lemei rachok ulefoali etain tzedek. I will raise my de'ah, my dat, my knowledge, my view, lemei rachok, far away. In other words, taking the mainstream view, I will publish my words far and wide. Ibn Ezra says, I'll publish my words to God, who is distant. But generally, it's understood as, I will publish my view far and wide. Ulefo Ali etain tzedek, which is a phrase that gets used in other contexts. I will give righteousness to my Creator, meaning I will justify my Creator. Follow? I'm going to show you how great God is. The idea of publishing far and wide, as understood by Rabbi David Altshuler and Mitzvot David, is to say, anybody can hear me and respond, I'm not afraid. I'm willing to say it, and anybody can hear me, and anybody can answer me. Ki omnam lo sheker milai, sentence 4. Ki omnam lo sheker milai, my words are not false. Timim deos imach. This clause, this latter half of the sentence, in sentence 4, is very hard to render. Timim deos imach. Rashi says, Timim deos, literally somebody of pure mind, is a reference to Job, who in the beginning of the book was described as being tam, and that's been a very big word all throughout the book, this word tam. We've seen it any number of times. So, Tmim Deos Imach, I'm talking to you, Job, you who think you are of pure mind. Another approach is that Elihu himself, in chapter 37, is going to describe God as Tmim Deim. So maybe it's a reference to God. I am representing God, who is the pure one. When I speak to you, not only is my speech not false, but I'm representing God. And then you could potentially take it a third way, Mitzudat David does, and he says, Elihu is describing himself. I am pure with you, meaning I am at peace with you. I have no disagreement with you. I'm on your side. Yes?
This is funny only because they've got Rashi wrong. They said what you said for the third one.
Yeah.
Rashi.
Interesting.
They said Rashi, but the moderns agree with Rashi that Elihu immodestly is speaking of himself.
Interesting. No, that wasn't what I saw in Rashi.
No, I'm saying.
Shana, you have Rashi there.
Yeah. I will now begin to speak to you. She'atasa hoshadat kashlema.
Right.
Because you reason or you believe that your opinion is correct.
Right, so I don't know what they're talking about. Interesting.
That's why it's okay.
No, but Eov says it's you. Okay, so we have what did they quote as Rashi in there?
Elihu immodestly is speaking of himself.
Huh.
And it says RV renders one that is perfect in knowledge is with thee.
Interesting. Okay. So we have multiple ways to take this clause. However you slice it, whatever you do with it, what you want to come away with from the opening four verses is, I still have something to say. God is still sending me messages for you, and therefore you should take them seriously. That's your upshot of your opening four sentences, and now he launches into what he really wants to communicate in sentences 5 to 15, which is going to be a throwback to chapter 33 in his opening speech. in which he said God communicates with people, calling them to repent, and he makes them suffer so that they will learn. And he's saying, Job, this is about you. If you take a look at source number 8 on your sheets, I brought you Rashi's comment to sentence 9, where he says, this is meant as a direct message to Job. This is not an abstract statement about how the world works. V'chol divrei Eliyu tanchumin shleimim hayu. Eliyahu's words are fully of consolation. They're all about consolation. They're not attacks on him. Kolomar, al tidag al yisurin, meaning don't worry about suffering. Im tzadakta, if you've been righteous, it'll benefit you. Your suffering is going to be good for you. Fundamentally, don't worry about it. That's the statement that Eliyahu is making to Job in this next section.
You can also see Eliyahu's never suffered.
Maybe.
If he had suffered like Job had suffered, I don't think he could have helped him.
You know, I don't know that that's true. I mean, suffering like Job suffered, I don't know from. But there are people who overcome great difficulties in their lives, and including a lot of pain, and then they become self-righteous when expressing themselves to others who are in that situation. And they can't really perceive what others are dealing with. Yeah. So I wouldn't necessarily draw any conclusions about Aliyah's personal experience. Maybe, though. So in sentence 5 is an important sentence for something that has nothing to do with what we're going to discuss now, but when we get to the end of his speech, I'm going to come back to this sentence, because it becomes a very important basis for a popular Jewish practice. Hein kel kabir v'lo yim'as kabir koach leiv. So translating it literally, God is mighty v'lo yim'as, and he will not reject, he will not denigrate anybody. Kabir, he is mighty. Koach lev, the power of his heart. Go back for a minute to chapter 10, sentences 3 to 4, and you will see what it is that he is responding to. Page 1633. Job had said back then, Hatov lecha, he's addressing God. Hatov lecha kisa ashok. Is it good for you, God, when you abuse me? Kisim as yigia kapecha. When you reject the work of your hands. So Job alleged that God is moes. And so Eliyahu responds, and he says, oh, no. Hein kel kavir v'lo yimas. God is mighty. He does not reject. He does not treat people with scorn. It's a direct response. Well, again, one of those cases where Eliyahu wants to demonstrate, I've been in the room and I've been taking notes. You know, and here's what I have to say in response. So he says, God is wonderful to people. Lo yechaye rasha. And he is just. He's not going to give life to the wicked. Umishpat aniyim yitain. We're in sentence 6. He is going to give justice for the poor. Lo yigram mitzadik einav. He will not remove his eyes, literally. He will not remove his eyes from the righteous. Ve'es milachim lakisei. And the kings to the throne. He'll put kings on their thrones. Vayoshivim lanetzach. He settles them on their throne forever. Vayigbahu, and they are elevated. But, sentence 8, v'im azurim bazikim, or he may bind them up in chains. They may be bound up in chains. Yilachdun v'chavlei oni. They will be captured with ropes of poverty. So he will elevate, and he will bring down. Vayaged lahem pa'olam, and he tells them what they've done wrong. How? Via suffering. That's how he communicates. Ufish ehem ki yisgabaru. He tells them of their sins when those sins become great. Vayigel oznam lamusar. He opens their ears. Vayigel is going to be an important word in this chapter. But he opens their ears for rebuke. Vayomer, and he says, ki yeshuvun me'aven, that they had better stop their wickedness. You follow? That's that section. A couple of thoughts on the section. First of all, the statement of he watches the righteous and he enthrones kings, right? So Rashi says it means he elevates the righteous to make them kings. But the Gemara on this is plays on the word yigra. I said yigra could mean for God to shift his eyes away, but what else could yigra mean? To make worse or to subtract. Geraon, right? Subtraction. So keep that in mind as we look at number 9. The classic passage from the Talmud. This involves something which I hope you're familiar with. The sentence said, Lo yigra mitzadik einav. So I translated that as, he will not reduce from the righteous his eyes. As reward for Rachel's privacy, she merited to produce Shaul, meaning she did something great in private, and as a result, she merited that King Saul came from her. Even though the Davidic line, the line of monarchy, would ultimately come from Leah, nonetheless, Rachel got a king first in Shaul. As a reward for Shaul's privacy, because of something that he did, he merited to produce Esther. So he merited to have Queen Esther. And there's a connection, there's more to be said about this. The Rachel, Shaul, Esther connection and the privacy element. But I'm focusing on the story here. The story picks up on a verse in Bereishit. Umait snius haisa baba Rachel. What was Rachel's privacy? What did she do in private? Dichsiv, the text says, Vayaged Yaakov l'Rachel ki achi aviyahu. When Yaakov meets Rachel, he says, I am your father's brother. Now, is he really her father's brother? V'chi achi aviyahu? Is he really her father's brother? V'halo ben achos aviyahu. What he is the son of her father's sister. Right? In other words, Lavan is Rachel's father. Lavan has a sister named Rivka, and he is Rivka's son. So he is not Rachel's uncle, he's Rachel's first cousin. Now, on a literal level, this bothers me not at all, because we sandwich generations all the time, biblically. We identify siblings as cousins and cousins as siblings. We identify grandparents as parents. That doesn't really bother me so much. But the Gemara picks up on it and says, no, we're supposed to learn something here. We're learning about an association between Yaakov and Lavan. And so it says, Ella Amar La, rather what happened was Yaakov says to her, Minsabali, marry me. Amrale, she says to him, in, sure. Mihu Abba Ramahu, but you have to know, my dad plays games. He's a trickster. Velo Yachlisle, and you're never going to win. Whatever game you play with Lavan, he's always going to come out ahead. So Amar La, he says to her, Achi Avihahu, he is her father's brother. Meaning, Achiv Ana Beramaut. I am his brother in trickery. I can beat him. Famous last words, right? Like the guy who says, I'm going to play the three-card Monty game, right? Good luck. The Umayra Miyusa, but he says to her, what exactly is the trickery anyway? What does it have to be afraid of? So Amrale, she says to him, Isli Achas et Kashisha Minoi. I have a sister who's older than me. He's not going to marry me off before he marries her off. So Yaakov says, I've got a plan. He gives her cues. Okay, he's going to say X, she should respond Y. And that way, he will know that it's really her. The night comes. Amra, she says to herself, Rachel says to herself, this is terrible. My sister is going to be embarrassed. Right? Because it's going to turn out that it's really Leah and not Rachel. He's going to kick her out. Everybody's going to know. Masartinu niyala. And so she takes the initiative to give Leah the signs. V'ainu dichsiv v'yiva boker v'hine hi Leah. And so the pasuk says, and this is really what they're trying to solve, the second half of it. Meaning the first problem this text is solving is why he identifies himself as Laban's brother. The second problem it's trying to solve is, why are we told that after the wedding, in the next morning, she was Leah? How does it wait until morning? Well, she, as the Gemara says, Michlal dat hashta lav Leah, she wasn't Leah until now. So again, if I'm reading it as a literalist, My answer is, no, he knew that she was Leah during the night. The point is, that's when he goes to Lavan and he launches his protest and he says, what have you done to me? I worked for you for Rachel and so forth. However, the Medrash says no. What it's saying is, she wasn't known to him as Leah until the morning because... Mitoch Simanin Shemasra Rachel Leah, because of the signs that Rachel gave Leah, Lo Havayadad Hashta. He didn't know until then. Every time he said what was supposed to be the password, he got the right password back. As a matter of fact, there are midrashim that go further that suggest that Rachel is in the closet under the bed, and therefore she's able to respond in her own voice, and therefore he doesn't figure it out. Leave aside the practical questions that come up with this. I'm not going there right now. If this were a class about Sefer Bereishis, we could talk more about that. But the point is that because she did this, which no one is ever going to know about until they read the Gemara, right? But in Rachel's time, no one is ever going to know what she did and say, wow, Rachel, you're a wonderful person. It's all tsanua. It's all private. Only she knows and Leah knows that she, and Yaakov knows, but his view is a little different. They're the only ones who are going to know what happened. And so what we're saying here is, taking our pasuk from Eov, Lo yigrami tzadik einav. God doesn't reduce anything from the tzaddik. His eyes see, and he rewards everything that a person does. That's what the Gemara is doing with Elihu's sentence. Okay. So God makes sure that he rewards everybody. He will elevate people to the throne, and he will reduce kings as well. God is in charge of kings, which is something we saw already in Elihu's previous speech. The idea of God as being in charge of kings. As a matter of fact, take a look at source number 10, another Talmudic passage, which draws on this speech of Elihu. Bishah Sheposkim Gedula La'adam, when they assign greatness to someone, they sort of should be like a capital T. When the powers that be assign greatness to someone, poskim lo ulzaro ad sof kol hadoros. So the default is that he's going to have it and his children will have it for all generations. How do you get that? Because of chapter 36, sentence 7, which says that v'es malachim lakisei. God puts the kings on the throne, v'yoshivim lanetzach, and he establishes them forever. So the default is that we have dynasties. V'im hegistato, but if the person becomes arrogant, HaKadosh Baruch Hu mashpilo, then God reduces him. And that's the next sentence, which said, V'im asurim bazikim yilachtun b'chavleoni. If they become arrogant, then they will be in chains and in poverty. So what it's reading here is divine control of the throne, which is very consistent with what Elihu has said so far. All of this is meant, ultimately, to draw the person to repent. Elevating them when they're good, punishing them when they're bad, is ultimately meant to lead to repentance. And so, if you take a look at source number 11, Mitzudat David says, Ubazeh yigle oznam, like he said, vayigel oznam. With this, he opens their ear, I don't know if it should be yigale, I guess, oznam, lekabel musar, he opens their ear to receive rebuke. Ukilu yomar lehem asher yishuvun min ha'aven asher yishilu lechoz ba, it's as though God is saying, get away from the evil you've done, you should repent, stop doing what you've been doing, ulutovan ken yechashev lehem, and if they do that, it'll be considered good for them. Okay. Back into the text, into Job itself. He says, Im Yishmu, sentence 11. Im Yishmu, if they listen, v'yavodu, and then they are obeyed, meaning they serve God, that's what he's talking about. Yechalu yimeim batov, then their days will end well. Ushnehem bani'imim, their years in pleasantness. Right? If you listen, if you heed the rebuke, go straight, it'll be good. Vim lo yishmu, but if they do not listen, bishelach yavoru, they will pass by the sword, which is a phrase that we saw in chapter 33, sentence, I had written down sentence 8, but I'm actually not seeing it in 8. He had used the word shelach before to refer to the sword as an implement of punishment. 18, thank you. Typo in my sheet. The chayasome of arba shelach, thank you. So, if they don't listen, then they... Oh, you know what? I did write 18 in here. That's funny. I missed the yud. Okay. If they listen, good. If they don't listen, then they are going to suffer. V'yigve'u bivlidas, and they will expire in ignorance. Those who have a cruel heart, they will end up being angry, or creating anger, I should say, upon themselves. Lo yishavu, they're not going to cry out ki asaram when God imprisons them. Tamos banoar nafsham, they die young. V'chayasam bakideshim, and their life among kideshim. Now, a kadesh is not a very nice word. A kadesh is a reference to a male who was given over for harlotry. So, what in the world did that have to do with this? So, Ibn Ezra just says it means youth. Yeah. So Ibn Ezra says it refers to, except males, but specifically, the kadesha will be the female. Ibn Ezra just says it means they die young. But Rabbag says it's because when they are young, that's when they have the fire of youth and they are suitable to be kadeshim. That's the reference. Mitzudat David says they will die a disgusting death, their life leaving them among the kadeshim. That's who their company will be, these people. So that's another way to take it. But the bottom line is the last sentence. Yechaleitz ani v'onyo. V'yigel, there's that word again, belachatz oznam. This is closing what we said in sentence 10, v'yigel oznam lamusar. He frees the pauper, or he strengthens the pauper, depending on how you read yichaleitz. He frees the pauper with his suffering. By bringing this pain upon him, he opens up the pauper's ear. In other words, God is communicating with them when he causes them to suffer. And Job, you should see this suffering that is a message to you. He still has not said what Job has done wrong, nor will he. And there's more to be said about that next week. But what he says to Job is, that's fundamentally what suffering is for. So what we've seen in the beginning of this fourth speech is the message that, first of all, I still got things to say. And second, God is communicating by protecting and punishing as appropriate. And that will include what happens to you, Job. We still have a few more sentences in this first theme. This piece of don't give up hope, God is actually helping you. There's more to be said. And then we'll continue with the second theme of this speech, which is how elevated God is above the human being. And I mentioned in the beginning, but for those who weren't here, we have class, God willing, next week, the 5th, and we have class on the 12th. And then we'll be off the 19th, the Tuesday before Pesach. We'll be off on the 26th, which is during Pesach. And God willing, we'll resume May 3rd. In terms of how far into Judaism